Welcome to the Cabin Culture Podcast, where we spend a little more time diving deeper into all the fun parts of cabin culture. We like to think of this as both the material and imagined expressions of how cabin lovers, dwellers, builders, designers, and dreamers wish to live a more simple and authentic life. On this episode, we're chatting with Spencer Kernia, who co-owns the retreat at Fall Branch Falls with his wife, Marcy, and two sons. We first met on Instagram and connected over a mutual love of cabins and data. And on this episode, we chat about the best and worst day of their build, how adding the cabin to their family has changed their sons for the better, whether hosting is nature or nurture, and the unique way they structure their rental calendar. I should warn, I'm not sure why, but this episode has more than our normal amount of swearing. Like, at least 4 to 5 F-bombs are dropped. So if you're listening to this in a car with kiddos, we might recommend you hold off until you have some headphones handy. I blame Justin. Okay, let's get to the conversation.
Oh man, we got the whole crew on tonight.
I know, oh, yeah. Sean's going to hide himself in a second. He has officially become our producer. So
What's up, Sean?
Hey, man, what's up?
Why are you going to go into hiding?
I'm taking the role of producer. There's too many cooks in the kitchen.
We don't let them talk.
Spencer, what? Your lighting is on point right now.
Did you see the picture I posted?
Okay.
I guess you did. You just reshared it.
Yeah, I'm so impressed you did this with all home lamps. I'm in a dark room with, like, I don't even know. You're making our YouTube channel look good. Thank you for that.
Well, how many lamps you got working? Anytime.
I am so excited for this. This has been a long time coming. But here we are. COVID is gone. We're doing better and we're ready.
You're alive and well and speaking again and ready to
That's
go.
That's right.
Well, I actually forgot you had COVID. I meant to follow up and ask how you were feeling. Sorry, Jan.
You could tell that he really cares about
Justin, that's terrible. I mean, even I followed up with Janice. I mean,
that's right.
Did you really?
Just like yesterday, I think.
Okay, I'm ready to dive in because we have a whole list of questions. And as we all know, my bedtime is at 9. So an hour really pushing our luck here.
It's just going to start.
That's right.
What are you drinking, whiskey? Jesus.
I mean, Janice, last time we talked, you said we were going to pop some champagne.
Oh, that's a good point.
You forgot.
Hold on. Let me
no,
go.
No, 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 no. It's fine. I've got my whiskey. I don't need champagne.
Okay, wait. But I don't even have a beer. Justin, do you have something to drink? Okay. Yeah. Is that water?
He's got a Yeti of water.
It's vodka. So,
Justin, you have 30 seconds to go get something better. Spencer, I'll be right back.
You're not alone. I'm still here.
You're not going to watch me pick my nose?
I can let you if you want.
Sean, how was the big snow?
It was nuts. We lost power. We obviously lost like visual and internet to our doorbell cam. We had just kind of updates from the guest, but I don't think we expected as much snow as we got. We knew it was going to be like a big storm, but he kept saying like, oh, I'm trying to dig out my car. Yeah. We finally saw it came back on the camera. 40 inches is crazy.
You got 40 inches of snow?
Yeah, we got dumped on. Yeah,
wow, we got like 10, but it wasn't that bad. I am sorry. And you lost power again?
And we lost power because the fucking generator wasn't hooked up.
Layla,
God damn it,
we don't have a generator. We totally should have one.
Yeah,
do you have one, Spencer?
No, we don't.
Yeah, do you lose power often there though?
We lose power once every couple of months, and it's not for snow, it's for high winds. I mean, there's like one or two roads in and out. And if a tree falls on a line, that's it.
Yeah.
For like 1,000 people, you know.
But long-term concern for you all, since it doesn't get that cold down there, I'm thinking about our North Carolina property. Is it more about freezing or is it just about inconvenience to guests?
Inconvenience to guests. We did have pipes freeze this winter though.
The Christmas one. Yeah. Every single house we own from Maine to North Carolina had lost power and had at least some bit of frozen pipes.
Yeah. Hey, how's my audio, by the way? I mean, I can change it up.
It sounds good.
Are we live yet or no?
We can be. I'm going to edit it. So I'll just, you know, figure it all out.
Okay. Better than Janice's audio. So we're in good shape.
When we first started talking about this podcast, I said to them on one of our first calls, I was like, listen, the only thing that I'm really picky about is the audio quality. You know, as a videographer, that just really matters. And then guess who fucks up the audio all the time on this podcast. It's not Justin, I'll tell you that. It's 100%.
And I don't do much. Janice is like, I swear to God, if you guys fuck this audio up, we're done. And we're like, holy shit. All right, I got the mic. I'm good to go. And then Janice has her mic backwards, not plugged in.
So legit. On that note, let's dive in. Can you start by telling us a little, for anyone who doesn't know you, just like a little overview of what you do in real life and then what you do in your Airbnb life or your cabin life? Let's say
wonderful.
That.
I should say that I'm like only half of the equation here. Marcy is our other half of the equation. And she,
that's right.
She's not here tonight. She fundamentally hates being on social media, but she actually manages and runs the majority of the cabin operations itself. So I'll get to speak on her behalf tonight, but she's not here tonight, unfortunately. So
shout out to Marcy.
in the real world, we both work full time. We're both in advertising. I work at a advertising agency, and she works at a local phone company. And we're full-time advertising people. And the cabin has been our on-the-side way to, I don't know, engage other people and have something that's fun, that's for us and for our kids. And it's just, it's a blast.
One of the things I love about following you on Instagram and hearing about your cabin life is that your kids are such a big part of it. And I'm curious how it's like changed your family dynamic since you've added like almost another family member, it feels like, with your cabin, how it's changed like what you all do in your free time and what changes have you, because your kids are old enough that I suspect you've noticed changes in them as well.
Unbelievably so. And that's such a good way of putting it, that that we've almost added another family member, because that is almost how our conversations go. Hmm. The kids ask about the cabin and how the guests are doing. And
it really is
a whole family thing. And I know that we post about that, but they actually do have jobs that they do at the cabin when we're there. Like as we're leaving, Miles, our younger one, he's seven now. He's the one that sets up the fireplace for the next guest before they come. And he's the one that's chopping the, you know, the kindling up. And Luke's the one that's helping picking up trash and picking up garbage and helping get the car loaded on the way out. So It really is like a whole family thing. You asked about how they've changed. And before purchasing the cabin and before opening and running the cabin, they weren't inside kids. I mean, we did a ton of stuff outside. But over the last 3 or 4 years, they've definitely become much more confident in their abilities to do things outside, mm-hmm. and their abilities to even do things independently from us. Before, they all, you know, always had to be in a room with us or always had to, you know, ask us for things. And now they just kind of go do things and they have that confidence in themselves to go do that. And I don't know if that's just from being out in the woods and experiencing and living in the trees for, you know, days on end, or if it's just something that they grow into. But mm-hmm. for sure, over the last 3 or 4 years, they've become much more independent in their thinking and in the way that they act outside. Like Luke, for example, our oldest, who's almost nine, used to be afraid and concerned with going outside in the dark, right? And now, like, he'll walk in the dark by himself, even at the cabin, and it's like not a thing for him, and he'll go out to the car, and it's just this sense of confidence that they've had since we've done it.
Was this part of your plan, like when you and Marcy first, and I'd love to know like when you first started thinking about this, if it was something you both always knew you wanted to do, if one of you came up with the idea, but when you started that conversation, was it intentional that like
not this- at all?
Interesting. No, you just started noticing it once you bought the cabin.
Totally unexpected. Yeah. We did spend a lot of time outside. We had a, here's a fun story for you. I don't know if we've told it at all. Before we bought the cabin, we had a 1955 Airstream. And I drove up to Grand Rapids and bought it, and we brought it home and refurbished it and spent like 2 years making this thing awesome and polishing it and totally redoing the inside of it. And when we found the land, that's actually what we sold to buy the land that the cabin's on. So we camped in the Airstream all the time.
With the boys.
With the boys, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So
this wasn't pre-kids.
No, that wasn't pre-kids. That was immediately before, you know, they were 1, 2, 3 years old when whenever that was going on. But that little Airstream that we bought kind of funded the start of the cabin.
Yeah.
You missed that Airstream?
No, not at all. Not at all.
I was wondering if you felt any sort of way about selling it.
It was
Justin
gorgeous.
Is getting ready to sell his.
I'm also selling mine. If you want to, you want another one? We have a 1969 land yacht.
No, no, we had a 1955 Safari 22 foot, and it was super cool. And we redid the whole thing, and it was just a love passion project and a headache at times.
Yeah. Was that the first thing, the first big reno project that you and Marcy ever tackled that got you into this? Or was there stuff before that, that led you to then buy that?
Yeah, there was small stuff before that. That was probably the first major thing. I mean, we've owned, I think we're in our fourth house now in 14 years of marriage. And the first 4 years of marriage, we lived in three houses and we would like work on them a little bit and then move on to the next place.
Was it like a flipping?
No, not at all. It was kind of just a product of work. My day job was would move around. And so we lived in this little town called Cartersville, and it was an old house right in downtown. And so that one had all kinds of stuff. That was really my first house that needed a lot of work that we worked on.
Did you have the skills when you bought that house? So you're like, I can work on this, or is that the house that taught you the skills?
No, I learned a lot at that house. I'm fortunate to have family members that know a little something about being handy. And so, you know, you call them and they'll come over and teach you how to do things, or you go ask your neighbor. I think that's one of the things that's important, is just finding people that have the skills to do the things and then having them coach you or learning from them.
Yeah. Okay. This is great. Cause my next big thing that I really want to talk about is the build, but before we get there, can you just like kind of describe, this is obviously not a visual medium, but can you describe for people like where you're located, what your land looks like? And I almost want to picture, cause I've started to picture it when you talked about the boys, but like, what does life at the cabin look like? Just so people get a feel of like where you are.
Yeah. So we are in a temperate rainforest and it's like right at the very southern end of that little rainforest that is in the Appalachian Mountains. And so we get a ton of rain. Everything's green. There's rhododendrons and mountain laurels and, you know, blooming things nearly, not quite year round. There's always green stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's a creek that runs right through. We're kind of situated in this little valley almost of two big hills that meet. And there's a creek that runs right at the bottom of those two hills. And so we're stuck right in there. The corner of our house is 6 feet from the edge of the water. And when we bought it, it was an old shack. I called it the old murder shed, you know, and it looked like it came out straight out of a murder movie thing.
What was its past life? Like what was it before? It was like a hunting cabin or?
Yeah, it just this couple who was now elderly built it in the 70s and 80s and camped in it a couple of times and used it as a getaway. But there was, you know, when we bought it, there was no water, no running water, no power, no septic, nothing. There's no cell service there. It's perfect.
Okay, now I have a question because it's small and you didn't really... Like it's pretty impressive the way that it is right near the water and it's pretty small. And I think the question probably a lot of people think when they see this is like, why didn't you just knock it down and like build something bigger? Why did you stick so closely to that footprint? Were there logistical reasons? Were there legal reasons?
Legal reasons. Yeah. So
okay.
Our property is like very thin and narrow. It's an acre or it's an acre and 1.8 acre, something like that. Very thin and narrow. So there's not really any other place to build anything. And it's super steep on both sides and comes right to the point of the creek. And really it's legal reasons. There was no other spot to put anything. And when we bought it, there's a grandfathered in law where as long as you're rehabbing a place, you can maintain the original foundation or at least the proximity of that foundation and keep the same location of the cabin. If we were to build that today, that property would never have anything on it. It's not shaped right to have any kind of structure on it at all. It's just, it was built before there was laws that allowed that to happen.
Yeah. I think that happens a lot, like, especially with a lot of these interesting spaces.
Yeah.
So what was it that sold you on it? The narrow piece of land, the murder shack, the proximity to water that could flood. Like, what was it that you and Marcy saw and you were like, this is it?
Yeah. So we've been looking for property for years, literally years. And we have always kind of kept our eye out for something. And we were actually working with a real estate agent in Blue Ridge, which is the kind of the closest big town that we're in. And when we were talking with her, we're like, here's what we want. We want a cute, cozy, quaint little cabin that's super cheap because we've got almost no budget and next to the forest and on running water and doesn't need a lot of work. But
a realtor's dream.
A realtor's dream. That's right. That's right. And she told us, she said, you're never going to find what you're looking for. And those are the exact words that she said.
I love her optimism.
That's yes. A good realtor.
Yeah. Yeah. She'd only shown, and it's not like we had worked with her for many months. She'd shown us like four houses. And she said, you're never going to find what you're looking for. And so in that moment, Marcy pulls up on her phone on Zillow, this property. And she was like, I really think we need to go look at this one. And I said, I don't think so. It's right next to a super popular hiking trail. I don't think that's what we want. She just said,
and I think like 10 people have been killed there. So maybe, maybe not.
It was like the worst Zillow pictures you can imagine. I mean, it's like someone took them with an old disposable camera and scanned them in, you know.
It was probably like a disadvantage even having pictures of this like old murder shack.
It
like if it was
probably was
out in like a gorgeous creek, I'm sure that you could have sold that thing for 10x. But looking at the shack, you're kind of like, yeah, maybe not.
Exactly. But she was insistent, and so we told the real estate agent, we're like, hey, we want to go look at this one. And she said, I'm not going to show you that property. Do you want that? There's no way that you want that property. I'm not going to show it to you.
Had she seen it before?
Yeah, she had. I think it was actually her company that had it listed.
Interesting.
So we drive down there, we leave her, we get in the car, and we're like, we're not working with her anymore, goodbye. And we get in the car and drive down there, and I mean, kid you not, my major thing was that it was right next to the most popular hiking trail in Blue Ridge, and which means it's immediately on the other side of the creek. People are literally 10 feet from the cabin, and I was like, I don't think that's what we want. And we show up, pull into the front of the driveway, and they've got this big ceremony going on where they're closing the trail the day that we show up, and they're doing like hot dogs and hamburgers and they're like, we're closing the trail. Like, oh my gosh, are you serious? So we go up and we talk to them, and they're like, we just say, hey, we're here to look at this property. And he's like, yeah, there's a real estate agent that's actually one of our members. It's the Benton McKay Trail System. I don't know if you know what that is, but It's a 300-mile trail system that runs up through North Carolina.
Really?
From Georgia up to North Carolina, yeah.
Huh, I haven't heard of it.
You should check it out.
I might could hike down to you.
You certainly could.
Just take me a little bit.
So they're like, there's a real estate agent that's one of the members of the Benton McKay Trail Association. He's here today. So that's crazy. So we walk up. I walk on one side of the creek. She walks on the other side of the creek. It's 50 yards from the road. And I look over at Marcy. And I'm like, this is it. Like, there's not a doubt in my mind at that moment that this is it. It just,
did she
like,
feel the same way? Cause so she was the one who wanted to go there.
Yeah. I look at her and she's grinning and I'm like, this is it.
She knew too.
Yeah. About that time, this guy comes walking up behind me down the old trail that's now closed. And he was like, hey, this trail's closed. I was like, you would happen to be a real estate agent, are you? And he was like, yeah, I'm Jeff. I'm with the Benton McKay Trail Association. I was like, this is crazy. So we're going to buy this cabin from you. And he was like, okay, I've shown it a few times. He was like, there's a lot of issues with it. There's a lot of red tape. And he was like the best. And we made it happen. We wrote in like a super long due diligence period. And it was so cool experience.
Between what you saw and the pictures that didn't look great. And then when you got there, I mean, what was the difference? What was totally just like different. That switch?
Yeah, totally different. The pictures were of the cabin, right? And that's not what we fell in love with. We fell in love with the land and the location.
Yeah. And that's what I found. And Justin, I think we talked about this, searching for land from a distance, right? Yeah. You're looking at all these listings online and there is just absolutely no way to tell land until you go there in person. You cannot, it's just a bunch of trees. It all looks like a bunch of trees. And they'll list how many acres, but you don't get a feel for what that acreage feels like or how hilly it is or what features are on it. You have to go there. And it is, I mean, I saw a bunch before we found the one we found. And the moment I stepped foot on that one, it was like, yep, this is it.
Yeah.
It, there's just something different.
It's almost this, like when you walk on the property, it's almost this feeling that you get, you know, that just like you get these little bumps on your arms and this tingle runs up your spine and you're just, it just has this feeling to it that I think to me is kind of quintessential cabin culture. Just this feeling you get when you're in the woods, in your space, alone, disconnected. And it's this like peaceful moment that you get. That to me is the cabin culture that I seek.
Do you still get it every time you go?
Every time
you spent. Yeah, okay. I wonder sometimes about people who have to build and do a lot of work. And Justin, I'd be curious how you feel about this because you didn't plan to do all the work and ended up doing it. But every build ends up being harder than we think it's going to be. Does that take away any of that feeling of hope and optimism the first time you go? And then all of these hard things happen on that same piece of land too. Yeah. How do you maintain that feeling you're talking about?
I think it is definitely tough, and only because some days when you're out there building, it's great and everything's going good. And you're like, oh man, isn't this great? We're out here banging nails. This is good. Mm-hmm. And then most of the time it's not great. And you have to remind yourself not to kind of get bogged down and all the negative. It's like, I don't want this to ruin this whole thing for me. You know, I don't want this bad day or this bad contractor to ruin this whole thing. Like, I just spent so much time getting to this point, and I'm sure it was probably similar to you. It's like some days you got to kind of just, I don't know, stay optimistic. But
what was the best day of your build and the worst day of your build?
Oh my gosh. Hey, I want to echo what Justin's saying. It's not that every day's easy. I mean, there's been so many tears out there and so much frustration and so many like just happen out there. It's not that everything's always great. And that's not what I intended to communicate. It's that, you know, when you pull onto it, it just feels this peaceful feeling, even though there's insane moments of frustration that happen all the time. Okay, best day and worst day. Do what?
I said at least it's when you're showing up at 7 o'clock in the morning with a coffee, everything's still good. So you can go, oh, isn't this great? And then 20 minutes later, everything's falling to shit. And then and then that's it. But that first 20 minutes is pure glorious. Bliss.
Yeah, pure bliss for sure. Okay, worst day. Worst day, I think, was we were probably 800 days in on a build, 900 days in our build. And that's not like all build time. That's from the time that we bought it, right? It was over a year from the time that we bought it to the time we started a contract with a builder. It was 13, 14 months.
Wow.
And so for us, it was, we're not patient people really, like by nature. And I think for us, it was the point, there was some point where a month had gone by and there'd been no progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 6 weeks had gone by and there's no progress. And you keep, like, we live an hour and a half from the cabin and you keep driving up there and there's no progress.
Mm.
And at some point you get to this point where you're just pulling your hair out. Like, why hasn't anything changed?
Yeah.
So that was probably, there's a couple of days in there that were just emotionally hard, not physically hard.
Mm-hmm.
Best day is probably the day we got to host our first set of friends there.
Mm. Now, when you built this, I always think it's interesting the path that takes people to hosting. When you built it, was it more for you, like originally for you all? And then you were like, oh wait, maybe we should host to like help make back some of the build money and help make this affordable. Did you buy it with the intention of hosting immediately? Like, how did hosting fit into that whole big plan?
Yeah. So we had a very clear vision, and that vision is the same. When we first bought the land, we felt like it was for us and for others. And our intention was to host 16, 17 nights a month. You know, we did the math, right? We're like, all right, we do the math. We can host 16, 17 nights a month. We can stay 4 or 5 nights a month, and then we can give the rest away to friends or family or somebody that needs a break. Marcy and I had a few stays in the course of our marriage where a break like that was important, critically important. And we wanted to be able to have that kind of place for other people. And so it's not just the people that can spend our $250 to $300 a night to go stay somewhere, but other people too. And we wanted to make sure we built that into our formula. That
I love that.
It was a place where, you know, even if you can't afford it, sometimes we can make that happen. So we rent, we don't talk about it much, but we rent 17 nights a month pretty regularly. And then we go 4 or 5, and then that leaves what, 8, 9 nights a month that we give. And sometimes that's 2 nights to an influencer and 3 or 4 nights to a family member. And sometimes it's a local preacher that owns a coffee shop in town that he's a dear friend of ours that he goes up all the time.
How do you work that logistically? Just curious from someone who would like to do something similar, but logistically that can be quite hard. Like, do you just open up the whole calendar and then once 16 or 17 book, you block off the rest and then find people and suggest it to them and see if the dates work, or just logistically, how do you make that work?
So this was a learning process for us, and we're still learning it, right? But we open up 6 months at a time. So we, and I think you do the same, Janice, you open up.
Yeah, we do 3 months at a time.
We open up 6 months at a time. So in August, we open up January through June, July, and then sometime in April, we'll open up December through April, something like that. Details on our Instagram stories. but we plan it out. And we block 3 or 4 nights in the middle of the week somewhere for our giveaway nights. And as they come up, you know, a couple of weeks beforehand, we can rent them out. And if we don't, if there's not like a person that is in need at the moment, or we don't have anything that pops up, then we either will go or we'll list them back again.
This is a smart way to do it, because I think what you said of we include that in our formula from the beginning, I think if you don't do that, then it's very easy to let other people control your calendar. It's the reason that we do 3 months at a time, because when you open it up completely, then we found other people were controlling when we could go versus us controlling and then sharing it when we could. So that makes a lot of sense.
And it's unfortunate. There's, and I know you talked about it on one of your past podcasts, but it's unfortunate Airbnb dings you for that because you're not fully open. You know, you're open, you're open 6 or 7 nights, and then you're closed for 3 or 4 nights, and then you're open 5 or 6 nights, and then you're closed. And that does have some sort of impact on the way that Airbnb works.
Yeah. But you probably don't struggle with that a ton because of the work that you've put into Instagram. So you have this steady channel. You don't rely on Airbnb so much for marketing as you do just for logistics of like, this probably helps you manage the bookings, but you're actually generating a lot of the traffic.
Yeah. I'm not sure many or any of our bookings now come from Airbnb.
Yeah.
You know, they're Levi Kelly or Ethan or Victoria, who does some amazing pictures, or our Instagram that people book through.
Yeah. Which leads me to my question about your Instagram. I think people tend to start an Instagram account for themselves, their business, or their cabin for a variety of reasons. When you first started the cabin Instagram, what was your vision and goal for it? What was the purpose behind it?
We were documenting like for ourselves, and it came out of the Airstream because I used so many people's Instagram, and there's some like Airstream specific sites that we were following along to help us when we were renovating our Airstream. We were just doing the same thing with that. We were documenting the progress and what we were doing and the thoughts we were having and decisions we were making on Instagram. And I grew up a photographer. I was a wedding photographer in college. And obviously I still do a lot with video and photography today. So it was a natural medium for me.
And so the goal was just to document and share with other people. It was not, I mean, despite your work in advertising, your goal was not marketing.
No, it was really a, how can we document this and how can we create a platform that somebody may find helpful someday?
Yeah.
And it's fun. I really do enjoy it. I mean, it's like something that I really find almost as a hobby, right?
Me too. I feel the same way. And I feel like the people who spend a lot of time on it are the ones who usually enjoy it, which is a good thing that it isn't work. It does feel like joy. How has it changed for you from the very beginning when you were documenting for fun and like, maybe someone will find this useful, maybe. And now like, you know, 70,000 people find it useful. How has that experience changed for you as the creator and how has the community changed?
Yeah. There's a small part of me that misses like having 2000 followers, you know? Yeah.
Why? What do you miss about it?
It's almost like when you have that few, it's just like this carefree posting of, you know, what I'm doing. And I don't know, you almost have this space to be creative when you gain a large chunk of followers. I guess that's large. It's relative, right? Mm-hmm. To me, it feels large.
Mm-hmm.
That's large to me.
You start to question and rethink everything that you do. And it's this constant battle in my head of, I just need to post what I want to post and what I enjoy doing rather than what's going to please the people.
Yeah.
And that is like a real mental battle. I don't know if you go through that, Janice.
Yeah. I mean, all the time. It definitely has changed from 2000 to 10,000 to, you know, 50 and more. It's been a different experience. I miss the community. I felt a much stronger sense of community with less than 10,000 followers. I think because they never hesitated to DM me, to reply to stories, to offer their input, to ask questions. And the more followers,
that's so true.
I think it stops people. I think they're like, oh, she's not going to see my message or she's not going to respond to it. And I get all the time when I do reply to messages, they're like, oh, thank you so much for replying. And I'm like, thank you so much for being invested in what we're doing, you know? Yeah. But early on, I didn't have to say that. Like, we all kind of felt like we were in it together in a way that, at least that's how I felt. I'm sure for them, it's like a blip on their radar. But for me, it felt like there were all these people who were just being really kind and supportive and involved.
Yeah.
And then the more followers you have, even some of the pen pals I made at the beginning kind of dropped off when we got more. And I was like, oh, I wonder what happened to them, you know? And I don't know why. It could have been, you know, a million reasons, but it feels a little bit lonelier with a lot more, ironically, than when there's a smaller community.
Now that you imagine being like a legitimate celebrity.
Oh my God.
Terrible.
Now that you're done with your build though, do you kind of like, are you stuck with like when you're making posts, are you thinking about potential guests seeing it or like potential cabin builders or like, I guess now how has that changed things now that you're done building? I think documenting the build, you were probably thinking about other people doing that, but now I think, has it changed at all?
Yeah, it has. And now it's what's hosting like. What is it like to host in a remote place? And what's that, the impact had on our family? And we should post more about our family specifically, but it ends up being a lot about the cabin. I think that's
a member of your family.
Yeah. A member of our family. I think that's one challenging thing is like our Instagram is all about the cabin, but there's this whole other side that's not the cabin. And we feel a little bit odd about posting when these people started following for the cabin about interjecting our family life into that. Yeah. So still TBD on if we're going to start interjecting more family life or not.
Yeah. Do you find it tricky posting about hosting? Because I found this transition hard. It was really easy for me to talk about the build and things that we were struggling with or things that were going well. Because the things we were struggling with were usually related to me, like fucking something up or making a bad decision. When it comes to hosting, the things you're struggling with aren't always you, it's guests. And we also use Instagram to market to guests. And so that line between honesty and like the one in particular that stood out to me was when the hot tub was left open and it was frozen. And I wasn't trying to call anyone out, but I posted about it because I was like, I didn't even know this could happen. Like, literally, I've had a hot tub in North Carolina for 6 years and I never once thought about this. And all of a sudden, my cleaner sends me a picture of a half frozen hot tub. And I was like, well, shit, the people need to know that this can happen, you know?
Keep it covered, y'all.
Yeah. And then also, it's good education. Keep it covered. This is a risk. But it wasn't, and no one got upset. So I didn't, but I did think later, like, oh, I hope they didn't see it and think I was trying to call them out. But like, do you struggle with that audience piece of like,
yeah, what for sure. people want? For sure. Yeah. We had somebody, we have all clad pants at the cabin and we had somebody steal a pan. And I don't know if it was intentional or unintentional. It was definitely like the weirdest thing that someone's taken.
Oops, it accidentally ended up in my bag.
Like, how do you steal a frying pan? Yeah. But we didn't post about it because I don't want them to feel bad about taking a pan. That sounds really odd, right?
Yeah, I did share the one really horrific guest experience we had this time. Yeah. I did share. And it was only, I shared at first, not about the guest, but just about what was happening across the street and how bad I felt and how I was responding to it. And is there any tips for how we do this better? And then when the guest left a one-star review and was like downright mean to me and bullying me via messages, I didn't share any of the messages or any of that, but yeah. I did share the experience just because that is also the reality of hosting and what can happen. And the only hate I got from that was from her friends, which is fine. And it taught me a valuable lesson though, which was the power of blocking people in the sense that this is my community. And if you're going to come into it and say mean things to me or in the comments that might make other people feel like this isn't a safe place, I'm not going to hesitate to block you. Cause that really messed with my mental health for like a good 4 or 5 days when I'm trying my very best and someone is like bullying me. But, and I do think it was helpful for me to share honestly in that moment, but it is a tricky balance. It's so hard.
Yeah. We honestly haven't had any crazy, terrible, bad experiences. We've had things we've had to overcome, but we don't have that story where someone threw a massive party and wrecked all the furniture, you know.
Yeah.
Minor stuff. Sure. But we've not had that terrible story yet.
And yeah. I mean, honestly, in 9 years of hosting, I haven't had that story either. So when people tell me they're scared to share their place because of that, I'm like, I'm just not convinced that's a real thing, but I'm sure it is, but
it happens. You only hear about it on those channels, those Superhost Facebook pages.
Yes.
That's like the only place they show up and they never talk about the positive. So
I know. I had to unjoin them because it made me feel so negative.
Sure. For sure.
When I chatted with Alexis a couple weeks ago, she said that she thought great hosting has a lot to do with our personalities and isn't necessarily. Was that
Kingdom A-Frame?
Yeah.
Yeah. Alyssa loved that one.
Yeah. I love her. And she said she's not convinced it's something you can learn. Like you can learn parts of it, but truly great hosts have something in their personalities. I'm just curious what you think. Do you think it's nature or nurture?
I think it's both. I think that you can learn it. Though I think it comes a lot easier if it's in your personality. Marcy and I both are in the cabin, in the retreat for the mission of it and what our vision is for it, how it can bring people together. And so every decision that we make is around that. And I think if there's one bit of hosting advice I could give, it would be to understand what your mission is and no judgment at all for what it is, just know what it is. Yeah. If it's a retirement plan, that's great. Make it a retirement plan and go for that. If it's to create this space for people, then do that.
Yeah.
But know what it is.
I think I have a good idea what yours is just from what you've shared so far, but do you mind sharing what your mission is with the cabin?
Yeah. Our mission is to create a place that allows people to connect or reconnect, specifically couples and individuals. We love our kids. Like we love our kids more than anything in the world, but we didn't build a cabin for kids. We built a cabin for couples and single people, specifically to get away from the day-to-day grind of everyday life. And we feel like that's what we designed the cabin for, from the architectural plans all the way up. The whole experience was designed for that.
I love that. Okay. So talk to me a little bit about the architectural plans. Did you do it yourself?
No.
Okay. Someone helped you with it.
Yes. So here's what we did. We got it, I don't know, 70% of the way there. We had Pinterest boards, we had drawings. We knew the shape, the constraint. When you talk to Pete, you talked about constraints, and I love that. And how constraints can make you more creative almost.
Yeah.
And for us, we had this exact perimeter space that we couldn't go out of legally. We couldn't go out of. We tried. They said no. So we got it close, and we knew generally what we wanted and what we wanted it to look like. And we had a local architect that someone connected us to that we sat down with, and over the course of 6 months, turned it into a drawing that we love. And it was iteration after iteration after iteration after iteration, and many glasses of wine of sitting down with the plans and cutting out like shapes of couches inside this and measuring out paper and moving things around to get it exactly what we wanted.
Is that what took the 13 months to actually start the build process, was the designing and getting that just right?
Yeah, that was part of it. Part of it was finding a builder. We interviewed and vetted many builders. And there's I think my story is a lot like Justin's story on builders. And we don't have to go into or hash that out, but finding a builder that's willing to do what you want to do and get on board with your dream is a big deal.
Can you talk a little bit about that process? Because I actually get asked about that a lot, and I don't have a good answer because my cousin is a badass builder and I just went straight to him and he delivered start to finish. Aren't so that's not lucky, a good answer.
Dennis, aren't you lucky?
I know. I'm sorry, Justin. You hate that. Most people hate that answer to that question.
Yeah.
So the question they're usually asking is like, do you have the plans first and then you shop them around to builders? Do you find a builder first and have them help you work on plans? What did that process look like for you?
So we had the plans first and then took those to a builder.
Just one builder.
No. We took them to a few and said, hey, here's kind of what we're wanting to do. It's a really unusual build. Meet us out here on the property. And some of them won't. Some of them won't meet you out there.
Why?
Well, we're 30, 40 minutes away from where they were. We're 20 minutes from Blue Ridge. They were, 25, 30 minutes away. So that was a challenge. Finding someone that's willing to work on our cabin's 480 square feet. This is a tiny project for them.
A cozy project.
a small profit margin project for them.
Yeah.
And we understand that. And finding that builder is a challenging thing for sure. And it really just takes time. It was probably 9 months from the time that we started looking for a builder to the time that we actually started building.
Yeah. I think that's something that people don't understand for anyone listening who wants to build a tiny space, which is a lot of cabin owners, right? And yeah. I went into it thinking I wanted tiny, one, because I love cozy spaces, two, I wanted to host couples, but three, I wanted to keep my budget down. And I was like, building a tiny space will help. And I think that's a misconception for a couple reasons. And we've talked about one of them before, but I think finding a builder is really hard because of the profit margin thing for a good builder. And my cousin is this way too. Afterwards, he got a bunch of requests to build that same cabin and they didn't want to do it because they knew if I build a bigger house or they do a lot of commercial work and breweries, like that is a longer, bigger, more expensive project. And as a business owner myself, I understand
that. Yeah.
I feel the same way about video projects. And so it is hard to find a builder who will take on a smaller project. I do think that's why a lot of folks end up teaching themselves the skills and doing it themselves.
Yeah. I would do it different next time. I mean,
what would you do different?
If I were in the position I was in 4 years ago, I would do a better contract with a builder. If I'm in the position I am now, knowing what I know now and how to do the things, I would probably GC it myself and go through that process. Though I'm sure that comes with its own challenges. but at least I'm in control of the project and the communication of the project.
Yeah. Justin knows a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely tough. I mean, because at that point now you're juggling all the subcontractors. It's like, if you have a builder,
yeah,
you're just yelling at him, dealing with him. But it's like, if you have all these subs, now one's complaining about the other one and you're not there because you're an hour and a half away. So you're not on site to see it for yourself. I mean, it's definitely tough, and doing it remote is, it feels impossible at times.
But I think if I could whisper in my ear 3 years ago, it would be to adjust my expectations and focus more on the build quality and creating the space rather than the timeline. I mean, we were so just like, let's get it done. And I wish we had been more, let's get it exactly right.
Yeah.
Even though it did take that long, it would have saved us a lot of heartache.
Because there's a lot of stuff you then end up wanting to redo later, and redoing it is infinitely or a lot more expensive than doing it right the first time, even though it does add cost often doing it right the first time, but it's hard to, I don't know, at least for me.
When it's a tiny home too, it's like a lot of people would think it's probably easy and simple, but it's like every detail matters and there's no room for error. Like, you can't mess up and hide it.
That's right.
If you make this wall a little bit off from this wall, it's like everything matters when you're only talking about 500 square feet.
That's right. And
yeah, it's crazy. You can't make any mistakes. You know, you get a big 2000 square foot home and you know, it doesn't really matter.
Hide no in one's the looking closet.
At the trim on your door, but if you have two doors in your house, that's all you're looking at.
That's right.
Know? So you pay attention to everything. It's crazy.
That's right. I love having conversations about big picture stuff, but I am going to zoom in really detailed for just 1 second, because I think this could help a lot of people. Can you talk about the contract piece? What would you have done different contractually with the contractor or the builder? And art, like, I didn't even know, if we're being honest, that there are different ways to do this contractually.
Yeah. I mean, you own your contract. The builder will give you a contract, but ultimately you're the one that signs it. So you're going to have to come to a negotiated deal with this other human being, right? So for us, it would have been, and this is just specific to our unique situation, what happens if the builder stops for 6 months?
Yeah.
Can we get out of that contract? Do we still have to pay the builder in these installments, or are we allowed to take our money back and walk away?
Yeah.
There's definitely those parts need to be in a contract, and it's just things you don't know when you're doing it for the first time.
Now, did you guys do like a lump sum? Was it like a
fixed amount? We had three installments.
But like, did he give you a price? Like, I'll build this tiny home for $500,000.
Yeah, was it that's right.
Cost plus. Okay.
Yeah. He gave you just a straight up price at the beginning.
Yeah.
See, mine was not that. It was more like, we'll give you a cost sheet that'll give you a general idea, but like, any of this could change along the way if things cost more to order, or, you know, you change any of it, obviously.
Yeah. And the thing that's tough is we were building, he started our build February 2020. And so we built February, March, April, and then things just really just completely stopped for a long time.
Yeah.
So
a case like that, it is important to note that having like a fixed lump sum contract could work to your advantage.
It did work.
You did agree to build it at a February price, and then those prices quadrupled. And in the summer, he's still contractually, he's tied to that number, where we did more of a cost plus. So it was like, you know, the cost of materials went up and so did our,
that's what mine price. Was too.
And, you know, and then labor on top of it. So, which they both have their, you know, their pros and cons, but in that case, kind of, you know, could have got lucky there depending on how things worked out.
Yeah, it worked. I think it definitely worked in our favor in that instance, but you know, still as a builder, if there's builders listening, freaking communicate to your people, you know, don't just go silent for months at a time.
Yeah. People will be infinitely more understanding if they have some concept of what's going on. Yeah. And even if it's not the answer they want, I think about this all the time at restaurants, because I waited tables for years, but like, if it's taking 40 minutes for my meal to come out, if you tell me that you dropped my plate right as that well-done steak was done and now it's another 40 minutes,
Bring me some biscuits.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I'm going to be hungry, but you're probably going to do something to make it better. If you just ignore me for the extra 40 minutes while you're cooking my second steak,
going to be a problem.
I mean, I'm just going to sit there getting more angry and more angry. And I feel like that's the same thing with builders.
It's just, yeah, it's a complete miscommunication, because to you, your house is their priority. Oh yeah, we're going to do this and that. But now to them and their crew, they're like, all right, so this is a little build. We're going to work this into our schedule when we have some downtime. And they're not going to tell you that. They want the job. They want the contract. And you can't blame them. And that's how
it goes. You can't.
Sometimes
you can't.
They just get busy and you get sidelined with your little 400 square foot cabin. They got a 4,000 square foot mansion they're building down the street.
And that was tough. I think that was a big chunk of the situation for us.
I think that happens to a lot of small builds. Again, I got so lucky, but I'm also smart enough. I've been through multiple builds before this one that as it was happening, I was very grateful. I knew every step of the way, how lucky I was that my cousin called me every day to talk through what was going on. And they were working on it every day and they, you know, did a great job.
Maybe another tip too, I could give listeners is if it is somewhat remote, like you were an hour and a half away and so were we. We did make it clear that, I mean, we went up there almost every single weekend. So we were clear with our builder, like, we're going to be there Saturday morning. So if you tell me you're going to work on the deck on Wednesday and I show up Saturday and there's no deck getting worked on, like, I'm going to know. So versus, you know, you go up there every couple months and they know they can get away with not doing anything for a couple months. But they know every Saturday Justin's going to be here in the morning. we can't lie to them, you know?
Yeah.
That's another little tip maybe.
Yeah, because if you don't go up, they learn that just as quickly, and then actions can change too.
We I'm were not there, saying all builders. Shows up.
Yeah. I don't think all builders are like trying to work the system by any means. No. And I don't even think it's always malicious. I think it's people running businesses trying to like do the best they can with competing priorities too.
Totally. And I totally agree. And I just think that's why it's important to make sure you have a contract, because everyone has the best intentions in mind. And we all need the same rules to play from.
Yeah.
Now, did you do any of the work yourself or was it all?
Yeah, we finished like the last 10%, which was fine. When we just kind of like took it over because all everything had stopped. That was what was so frustrating. It was like all but done. We finished the last little bit of it. We're actually, here's a little secret for you. We're actually putting in an upstairs.
Oh, I've seen it on your Insta story. You've been sharing some of it.
We shared some of it on the stories, but we've not talked about it any more than that.
Are you going to be hosting more guests because of it? Or are you keeping it to couples?
No, it's just for us.
Okay, just for you.
Yeah. So the downstairs is 440 square feet inside space and 480 square feet in total. And so the upstairs is that same size. But you know, it's got the sloped ceiling. So there's now actually three twin size beds up there, all built in bunks, and there's a bathroom going in and hardwood floors. And so we worked December and January. We closed the cabin and worked on it for 4 or 5 weeks.
This seems important as your boys are getting older.
Yeah, they're kind of tired of sleeping on the floor, and the couch is only like 3.5-4 feet long. And so one of them, if they're on it, they're curled up and crunched. And they were like, can we just camp outside? We'd rather do that than sleep on the floor.
I love that.
Yeah. So now there's a space for them, but it's fully hidden.
Did you have the second floor in mind when you initially drew this up?
Was it something down the road? Yeah, we did. We just never finished it. Yeah. We had a thought in mind that it could maybe one day be something if everything works out great. And you know, it did. So we put in a little secret hidden ladder that no one knows is there. And it's got a little access point behind a picture, and it's cool.
Ooh. Okay. I have questions for you about that off air. Yeah. Because we have an additional loft that we don't want guests to use just because we like hosting couples as well. And like, you know, 4 people at the most, but for my own use and wanting to host my nephews and my family, we need to hide a little ladder. But We only have a couple minutes left, and I have one more big picture question for you, which is so interesting. So I've been an Airbnb host for like 9 years. I started in my house and then moved to cabin. So I've been like watching Airbnb for a while, and it feels like it started in houses and apartments as just a way to travel in different cities. But recently cabins have really started, and this could be just my exposure and obviously what I pay attention to on Instagram, but it seems like they're having their moment right now. What do you think it is that travelers, that's changing about travelers, that's bringing them more to cabins than they ever have been before?
Yeah. So I think this is a interesting question. Our community of Blue Ridge is a cabin community. I mean, that's like, we've just, I don't know the percent, but it's a large chunk of the houses in our community are cabins. And I do think that there is a cabin moment happening right now. And I don't know if it's the culture around it, that peace and relaxfulness that's just gets me away from the day-to-day grind, that if that's the thing, or if it's being pushed by Airbnb. I don't think that's what it is. I think it's more this social moment of us needing a moment to breathe, because we've all been through the chaos of the last 3 years.
Yeah.
We all need that. That space to exhale.
And it feels like there's a movement called cabin porn, which like is obviously about the escapism, that we can scroll all these beautiful pictures. Yeah. And even that just gives us some sense of peace, but there isn't like a, maybe there isn't, I don't know about it, but there's not like a mansion core, like a, even a beach house porn, or like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's just like, it doesn't feel like it's showing up in like other types of houses in the same way that it's showing up with cabins. And I'm just curious about why people are being more drawn to that right now.
Yeah. I think part of that is what you view. You know, you buy a red truck and all you see are red trucks, right?
That's what I wonder, if it's just, I'm so deep in this world that I can't get out of it.
Well, I mean, look, MTV Cribs, the mansion thing, MTV Cribs has been around forever. People are fascinated with that world. But I do think that they're so photogenic, and there's this like dream life of that. I don't know if everyone does this, but I do just dream of like, let me just go live in a cabin in the woods and be quiet. And I think that's like an escapism thing that some people want, and you can find that. And Instagram's great at visualizing that. Mm-hmm. And it is great being in a cabin by yourself with no internet or cell service. It takes getting used to, and it's fabulous once you do.
Which is your current status right now, right? You're there by yourself. That's your current status right now, right? Tonight you're there by yourself.
Or? I'm here at the house by myself. The kids are upstairs. They haven't come down. They're asleep, I think.
I love that your house looks like a cabin. You guys can't see him, but he's like surrounded by wood and a wood stove in the background. I understand your confusion, Justin. It looks like
I thought you were at the cabin.
Oh no, this is home. We're on the back porch. Oh,
it does look like you're at a cabin though. Yes. So good job.
Yeah. Well done.
The fireplace was, we bought it after we bought the one at the cabin, and we fell in love with the majestic fireplace at the cabin. And it's an old, I know you can't see it. It's a 70s retro fireplace.
I was going to correct Janice on her story, because she mentioned how nice the wood stove was, and I was going to tell her that's actually a fireplace, and I learned that as well. I was looking for wood stoves, and I really like that one, and someone's like, well, it's a fireplace, and I'm like, oh
really? I looked at those too.
Yeah, there you go.
It's really nice. Spencer, is there anything that you wish we had asked you about? I'm always curious if people have things they want to talk about that we're just not getting to.
I had somebody ask this question. This was an Instagram question that came in a couple days ago. So shout out to Instagram. Someone said, my parents have 7 acres and we want to build a cabin on it. And do you have a full-time job, or is running the Airbnb your full-time job? Mm. I don't talk about my full-time job on Instagram often or ever. But yeah, we do. We have my wife and I both have demanding full-time jobs. And we give that everything that we have. And the cabin takes 10 hours a week, probably of nighttime work, of getting stuff set up, and probably at least a full weekend a month of prepping and buying and writing notes and stuffing bags and getting the cabin space ready for the next month for the guests. So you can do it if you have a full-time job. It just means you have to give up a lot of your extra not work time to run the cabin, mm-hmm. which we love doing. Yeah. It's really our joy.
And it makes us even more grateful that you chose to spend an hour of your evening with us tonight.
There you go.
Thank you so much for doing this.
It's been a blast.
This has been really fun. And for your great lighting and audio. Well, truly a treat.
Oh, you actually got your fire going too, huh?
It's real, Justin. It's a real fire.
I just saw one little
legitimately going.
Boring.
Look at that. Here we are in our boring basement and office at home.
That was fun.
That was fun. Thank you for joining us.
It's 9:30 and you are about to fall asleep.
That's true. I am. The time change has helped a little bit. Of all weeks for us to do this at 8:30, this was a good one. Thanks so much for joining us. And if you liked what you heard, feel free to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or share some of your favorite parts over on Apple Podcast in the reviews. If you have feedback or suggestions for the future, you can find us on Instagram at Cozy Rock Cabin and at The Chalet Frame, spelled The Chalet, C-H-A-L-A, Frame. Looking forward to next week.